Hey, it's me, Whit Schiller. We're about halfway through season one of the Improv Comedy Connection, and our seventh episode is a fun one. We get to spend some quality time with Will Hines. Many of you will know Will for his work with the UCB and also his books, How to Be the Greatest Improviser on Earth, and the recently released Pirate Robot Ninja book that he co-wrote with Billy Merritt. Billy was interviewed on episode two of the podcast, and he is the pirate to Will's robot in many ways, as you'll hear. Anyway, some of the reasons to listen to the whole episode, if you're not already locked in because it's Will Hines, include a peek into key moments and lessons learned in Will's journey from student to one of the most respected performers and instructors at the UCB. If you're an improviser, you're sure to get some value out of that discussion. And if you teach, you'll get some great insights into not only how Will teaches, but how some of his most impactful instructors work with their students. So get comfortable and enjoy the Will Hines episode of the Improv Comedy Connection.
Let's go as deep as you want.
Okay. All right.
That get aggressively good. Personal. I'm fine. Attack everything.
All right. Well, then let's just jump in and okay. I will attack Will Hines on the Improv Comedy Connection. This will be fun. Will, there's a lot of things that we could talk about when it comes to you and improv and comedy. You're a giver. You just give. You've given us a given us a couple of books.
Right.
I don't count your improv nonsense one because that's more a compilation, right? Of just
that's right. It's just like I was just drunk on the ability to make books easily and was like, what if I just want to make a book? I that's not totally true. I had this but I agree. It's not a real – I didn't, like, write or edit it. I just dumped an entire blog with no editing into paper form. I mean, it's the laziest blog-to-book experience possible. So, yeah, that doesn't count.
But you had to
that
come up with a cover.
I hired a guy
– Oh, so you didn't even do
worked
that.
With on my other book. No, I didn't. No, I did nothing. But for real, I was like, how much for you to lay out 600 pages of blog? And he quoted me a price, and I was like, let's do it. So yeah, that I did nothing. I sent him over the text and he did it all.
There's a lot of good stuff on your blog. There definitely is.
I think so too. Like, I guess I did the blog on this format called Tumblr, which I mean, I suppose people remember, but there was a time when Tumblr, at least amongst my friends, was like everybody was very active on it and everybody had a Tumblr account. It was like every day you'd go to Tumblr and check out what all your friends had posted. And then for some reason, it just started fading out of popularity amongst my friends, at least. I mean, Tumblr still exists. And I think for like photographers and illustrators, especially, it's big. But amongst my comedy friends, it was like fading. And I could feel my blog being like ignored. And so I was like, well, I'll just preserve it as a book, like mostly because it's easy and it'll give me the satisfaction of completing a task. But truthfully, I do think there's like really good stuff. And I was like, well, if anybody ever wants it, you can get the whole
thing.
What
do you think are some of the things that stand out to you from that blog that you thought were particularly helpful or meaningful to you?
I wrote a whole section on the phrase accept offers and sort of like, what is improv like if you filter it all through the mantra of accept offers, which is just a more bossy way of saying yes and. But I was like in love with the phrase accept offers at a time. And I was like, let's just try. And I came up with all these examples and sort of like do's and don'ts. And I thought it ended up being like kind of useful. I was sort of surprised. I was like, oh, this actually came up better than I thought. And I thought it was sort of a rare instance of brief instruction that I think could actually impact and improve somebody's play. Okay. I think so. So there's an accept offer section that I like. There's also a couple essays on why aren't there more women doing improv? And I write about the UCB's attempt at that time. This was in 2012 to like change the demographics and have more women stay. And at that time, it was all dudes in charge of everything pretty much, which certainly was I say that was part of the problem. I mean, I'm sure it was. But the challenge was I believe nobody really knows for sure what causes a demographic thing to stay the way it is. I mean, there's lots of reasonable guesses, but no one, if the air condition's broken, I know what will fix the air conditioner. If it's all men in your community, I have guesses, but I don't know for sure. So I wrote about things we were trying. And I think that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's toward the end. That stands out. In the very beginning, I was coming in hot. And I had a lot of stuff about dealing with references in improv.
Like pop culture references?
Yeah, references. Yeah. Like dealing with pop culture references you haven't heard of. And then there was another section on like defending fast, screamy improv, which I think like people always sort of worship at the altar of slow, patient improv, which is wonderful. But I was like, hey, man, what's wrong with fast, screamy improv? Yeah. That can be really fun, too. And I think that was fun. I mean, these are all like, you got to be an improv nerd to even read the title of these blogs and be interested. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is not like, this is not something that anybody who's like a level one student would even understand enough to care, or like, you know, it's a real niche audience, but it's important to me. So it's just sort of like, I really believe that everybody should write books. I know this is crazy, but I'm like, everyone should have a book. Like, I'm in LA, everyone has a podcast. You have a podcast. And I think that's great. But I think everyone should have a book. Like, write, I'm not talking about like a masterpiece, you know, massive novel, like write a little 100-page book on something that you love, a nonfiction book of your thoughts. Like, humans are so smart. We've all accumulated knowledge. Let's just, you know, let's put it out there a little bit.
I think there's something to writing out your thoughts. At least that works for me, because I'm working out one, trying to figure out how like our personal flaws or defense mechanisms or go-tos work themselves out in improv, because I think improv is a pretty personally revealing art form. And so if you're going to do it well, you've got to deal with your stuff too along the way.
That's right. I think it's good for the author, and it could even be good for the reader.
I often talk about the improv journey that people have. I think people can probably get that from you in a couple of different spots. I wanted to hone in, though, on a moment that you describe in your book, How to Be the Greatest Improviser on Earth, where you talk about...
Thank you for knowing of that book and mentioning it. I love that book.
I do, too. I recommend it a lot, and everybody who has ever picked it up has been really excited about it. And these are improvisers. And it's a book written for improvisers.
Yeah.
But in that book, fairly early on, you talk about what you felt was like your first time of feeling like you were doing improv right.
That's
right. And this, I think, was the Santa Claus sketch or scene or something like
that. Yeah, that's right.
So first, I'd like you to kind of set up that moment, not so much in terms of the sketch, but like, where were you in your improv journey at this time?
Oh, yeah.
What felt like it clicked at that moment for you?
Oh, yeah. I obnoxiously love talking about this moment. So I'm happy to do this. I talk about this in the introduction to the book. And it's basically like, I was 2 years into doing improv, right? 2 years from like my first class. I had been on a team at the UCB Theater for a year. So there was a year of taking classes and practicing and training, and then a year of doing shows on the regular, okay? And I was on a team that had some really funny people. I did not feel that I was one of those funny people. I sort of felt like I was holding on for dear life. I mean, I felt like I was okay. Like, I felt that I was like smart and would listen well, and I wouldn't like break things, but I didn't always feel like I was adding a ton.
And this is early on in the UCB, right? Yeah, it's a very different environment.
Oh, yeah. This is 2001, and the UCB was on 22nd Street in Manhattan, and it was, you know, you'd go to Herald Night, which was the weekly show of house teams, and that house would be half full only by the other Herald teams and maybe like 20 students. Nobody was watching us. Mm-hmm. The premier shows, which was when the UCB 4, the people who owned the theater, they would do a Sunday night show called ASCAT. That would be sold out. That was very in demand. And then there was a couple other shows at that time, an improvised movie, an improvised real world episode that would get like pretty big crowds. Mm-hmm. But other than that, nobody was watching shows at UCB. It was just the other students. And so, you know, and there was very few classes. Like, you know, I took level one. There was 5 simultaneous level ones, and that was the biggest level. So you could easily be on a first name basis with every single person taking classes. That was like no big deal. And, you know, now there's like 40 simultaneous level ones, you know, and there's, I don't even know everybody who's on a team at the UCB. It's a much bigger, it's like basically a small liberal arts college. And back then it was more like a group of deluded idiots who were like doing an art form that nobody liked, including myself.
Including yourself.
I hated it. I was like, this sucks, I said to myself. You know, but I was a computer programmer during the day, and I was doing this at night, and I was thrilled to be there, but very scared. And in general, I was lucky enough to be in a team with a couple of just people who I thought were geniuses. A guy named John Gemberling was on my team, still one of the funniest people I know. Curtis Gwynn was on this team, and he's just like this incredibly smart, funny person. Everybody on that team I loved. But anyway, so the moment I talk about in the book is up and for a while when I first did improv, it was very like rules oriented. You know, I was very like analytical about it. I was like, okay, I gotta, you know, I got to set up a who, what, where. So I would do that. Check. I would like say it. Hello, mom. Mm-hmm. The garden looks nice. Oh, okay. I did it. And then you got to find an unusual thing and heighten it. So I would listen for an unusual thing. And I would very obviously say like, hey, that's weird. You shouldn't, you can't yell at your flowers. That makes them feel bad or something. And I guess it was going okay or whatever. Like that was working all right. But at the time I write about in the book, yeah, I mean,
it sounds good.
What I just said was perfect, obviously. So
yeah, yeah. I'm writing it down.
But you know, if you follow the rules, even sort of badly, it does work to a certain degree. But I wasn't like crushing it anyway. So mm-hmm. I started taking an acting class on the side where it would be like you'd bring in a monologue and like you would just like read the monologue to like the rest of the acting class. You would learn the monologue and you would perform it. Monologue scene study, that's like a pretty common acting class format, especially if it's like a drop-in situation where you're just hand somebody like $30, they listen to you do a monologue and give you notes. But it was really affecting my improv because in acting you had a script. It was nothing about what you said, it was all how you said it. And he kept saying to me like, simplify, don't think about it, like just leave a pause at the end of the sentence where you feel what you said, you know, and do it all internally, just trust that we'll notice it, don't like explicitly perform anything. Just try to really feel it and see if we'll notice it from the audience. You know, it was that kind of like minimalist natural approach. So, okay, this improv scene that I was doing, it was, there was something about like Santa Claus and his workshop and all of the elves were revealed to be robots and they started like failing or something. And on the back line, I had this notion. I was like, oh, this looks like an evil plot has been launched against Santa Claus. That's what it looks like is happening. I was like, oh, you know what? I'll just be the villain. And I wasn't thinking like, what's the game? How is this unusual? Is this funny? I was just like, I'm going to just be a villain and I'm just going to feel evil, right? Like just what my acting class was telling me, just feel evil and trust that the audience will notice it. And so I just entered the scene and I didn't try to have an evil voice, right? I was just like, I am evil and I hate Santa Claus. And then I walked in and I just said something like, ha ha, Santa Claus or whatever. And the audience like laughed like bigger than they'd ever laughed. Probably not actually that big, but just from my perspective, I was like, whoa, it hit like they like me. I got them. And then I kept being this evil guy and they like ate up this evil guy. They loved it.
So the rest of the scene was also you were carried by that moment.
That's right. And I felt like I couldn't do anything wrong. Like it was revealed that me and Santa had an evil history. I remember he called me Fitzgerald and that I was jealous of him or something. And then I panicked and I started talking too much. And I remember the scene ended badly. But I had this moment of like power where I was like soaring above the skies. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm becoming an actor. You know, I'm like getting good at this. I have it on tape, actually. I'll send it to you. Wait, we can watch it later.
Oh, okay.
I'm only kidding.
Oh, okay. I'd watch it.
I do have it on tape. I'm kidding that I will make you watch it.
One of the reasons I pursued this podcast and tried to have a little different angle was on finding those moments of connection.
Yeah.
And in your book, in the intro, you describe this moment as a moment of connection between you and the audience.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, instead of being up in my head and thinking, I just was feeling the moment and people like that. They can tell when you're doing that and they like it.
Yeah. And I relate it a little bit to, and I've heard you say this and others say this as well, is that one of the reasons improv works is because people can smell the bravery on you.
Yes, that's right.
And if you are present, that is an unnaturally brave thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. It's not normal. Like we have walls up all the time, whether we mean to or not. And certainly when you're on stage and it's improvised and you feel that you have promised the audience that you will be smart and funny, it is natural to be like a little scared and be a high status and try to be above it and comment on it and be in control. It's totally natural, totally rational. But ironically, the only time or the best way to connect with the audience is to stop doing that, stop being in control, just feel the moment so fully that the audience can see it on your face, trust that they'll see it, and they'll start to laugh more. That's when you start to get those laughs where somebody says hello to you on stage and you go, oh, hi. And like, it will get like a little bit of a giggle because even though it's not a joke at all, they can feel that you are truly in the moment and not trying to think ahead, and it becomes like exciting in a very small way. Yeah, you're in the moment with the audience. You're watching it like they're watching it.
I remember a workshop moment, just a, you know, kind of 101, 102 kind of deal, and the scene was about being at a one of those stations in the zoo where you feed the goats, and my scene partner was feeding the goats, and I said, "Oh, you got to put your thumb down, otherwise they'll bite it." And that got a laugh. It's not funny at all.
Right,
but there's
right.
something about it, just we were all seeing the same thing at the same time.
Yeah, you were being in the moment, you were being real. Your attention was not on how well you're doing. You know, there's nothing less funny than trying to be funny. And there's right. nothing less real than trying to be real. The effort is what ruins it. So you have to weirdly do this in a way where you're not trying. I mean, you have to, you know, this is a combination of things. Like, I think if I had tried this approach of being very present my first day of my first improv class, it wouldn't work. Like,
nope.
You do have to think for a while as you're like just practicing making stuff up. There is no other way to do it than to be effortful and to try for a while. Mm-hmm. But ironically, it won't start working until it's like learning how to dribble in basketball. Like, when mm-hmm. you very first learn, you have to look at the ball and you have to watch it go from your hand to the floor and back up. And if you try to walk while you dribble, you can't take your eyes off the ball because you're learning. But at some point, you're not going to be able to play basketball until you can do it without looking at it.
Right.
And that's when you get good. And that's kind of, I guess this moment I describe in the introduction is when I looked up from the ball and I was just like watching the court, you know, that's like what it felt like. And I did try in that book to just like, rather than write what I thought I should write or what I thought the right answers were, I was like, okay, just like what happened to be the big moments in my life? I'm going to write about what I learned from each of those moments, basically. That's sort of what dictated my outline.
I think it was 8 chapters with kind of 8 major points were tied to certain moments that you pulled from.
Yeah.
So after that first, or that show we just talked about, by the way, I'll send you my video on the goat feeding.
Yeah, yeah. We'll
compare
them.
Notes.
Yeah.
But what did that next show, how did that go?
I remember going into a phase, I don't remember exactly, but I weirdly do, because we had 2 shows that day and I asked a guy to videotape them. So I have videotape of the first show and the next one.
Okay.
And I was less good in that next one, mm-hmm. but still better than I had been. Like I had become a more powerful performer. Like, it's just true. Mm-hmm. I had reached a level of comfort where I could be chill. But yeah, I'm sure it was up and down. I mean, I remember our team was really not one of the good teams for some time. There were way better teams at UCB than mine, although we did get good later.
Did you continue to do acting workshops after that one that you just mentioned?
Yeah, I did it for a little while. I did it probably not for that long. I did it for like 6 months. I mean, that's nothing compared to how some people pursue acting stuff. Yeah, I just did like 6 months of it. And other than that, I did keep taking classes, but they were all at UCB. I just really liked the UCB classes. So I didn't do too much outside of UCB after that.
Is there somebody in particular that you felt had the biggest impact on you and your style of improv?
Yeah, my teaching-wise?
There were
3 teachers. I had nothing but good teachers. I loved them all. But the teachers who had the biggest impact on me were Armando Diaz, Ian Roberts, and Kevin Mullaney. Those 3, I made huge strides. I took each of their classes multiple times. I took Armando like 4 times. I took Mullaney 3 times. Ian, I took 4 times. I just, you know, I liked their vibe. Like, I liked their approach. I liked them personally. They ran classes pretty efficiently. Like, you know, it was, I really got a lot out of it.
Were there some things in each of those that you think stands out in terms of what you learned?
Yeah, they were all good for different reasons. Mullaney was my level 1 teacher, and Mullaney is just like, he teaches without any ego at all. Like, some mm-hmm. teachers are also amazing performers, and the way they are good teachers is they kind of put on a show for you, and mm-hmm. they have a lot of charisma, and they're like encouraging you and charming you. Kevin is a very good improviser, but his teaching approach is he's out of it. He just gives you the exercise, and he just gives you a little mantra, and it's like he tries to let the exercise do all the work. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't even notice how good Kevin is, I think, until you've had another teacher, and then you realize that everything you remember is what Kevin told you. Like, Kevin would just like, you know, he's the guy that would just be like, hey, try nodding more. You'd be like, what? He's like, when the other person's talking, just try nodding. Let's do an exercise where you have to nod every time somebody else is talking. You'd be like, what are we doing? And then you get up and you nod the whole time, but then it works. It doesn't make like the whole scene great the whole way, but there is this impact that it has. And you're like, oh, nodding works. And then like later in an improv show, you're dying. Like, you know what? I'm going to try nodding. And then it helps a little bit. And you're not thinking, I need to be inspired by Kevin Mullaney, but you're like, oh, he gave me like, I don't know, 15 like practical tools that work. And he's just a really thoughtful teacher who I think very consciously tries to find what are little tools that work. Like he doesn't try to do it in a big inspirational way. He's like, you know, change status or something like that.
Yeah, we just had him at a conference in May, and it was very much like a toolkit. And some of the tools were tools that he was still working out, which was, I thought, very interesting to...
Yeah, he never stops thinking about it.
Right.
As I became a better improviser and a teacher, I would always talk to Kevin and be like, and just like ask him what he was thinking about, because he was always working on teaching.
And then Armando?
Yeah. So Armando, Armando was probably the most impactful teacher, although like I said, all my teachers are good, and Mullaney and Ian were very impactful. Armando was the most because his approach, I took him in 2000 and 2001 and 2002. His approach at that time was like, he also was like, he's a shy, soft-spoken energy. So he doesn't like dominate the class. So you get up a million times in an Armando class because a lot of times you just won't get notes. You're like, okay, two more. And you get up like twice as much as you do in any other class. That was my experience at the time. And then it's side coaching. Armando was the best side coacher of anybody I've ever seen. He side coached in two ways. He would laugh very consciously when he liked what you did. And he would have just like very slight adjustments. Just like you'd show a little emotion and he would wave his hands up like more anger. And you would just start to do it. You know, or he'd be like, you know, you do have a wallet. You have enough money. Or he'd stop and be like, what if you're a good trumpet player? Let's try it again.
Mm-hmm.
So fast, he barely interrupted the flow. And you'd go, you know, you would first be a trumpet player who's bad. He'd pause, be like, okay, let's try it. What if you're a good trumpet player? Go ahead. Yeah. You know, you don't even have time to think about it. You just start being a good trumpet player. And it had such huge impacts on the scene. Mm-hmm. And I took Armando four or more times. I can remember, maybe it was just four, but just four. I mean, that's a lot. Yeah. But what I started to notice was the first two classes in an Armando course would be like a waste of time. They would feel like a waste of time. You'd be like, what? This sucks. This guy's doing nothing. We're getting like, he's not giving us any notes. The exercises are obvious. This guy's an idiot. I mean, I would never be that angry, but I would just sort of be like, nothing's happening.
All four times?
Yes, even the fourth. Well, I started to be aware of his tricks on the third time. So the fourth time I was really watching, I was like, yeah, he's not doing anything these first two classes. But then like... Because people had gotten up so much in the third and fourth and fifth, people started getting like more confident. Mm-hmm. So the shy people that I thought were bad were starting to really come out with some swagger and some confidence. They were getting better.
Mm.
So all the zeros in the class, all the duds, were not so much duds anymore. They were like coming to life. And then his side coaching started coming in. And then in the last two or three classes, he started like making these adjustments, making these little moves. And by the last class, we were all good. Like the last two sessions of an Armando class would just be an ensemble. Everybody was up and moving and good and confident. And I was stunned. And it happened every class. And for years, I mean, still sometime to this day, and this is now almost 20 years later, if I am feeling unconfident in a performance situation, be it an audition or an improv show, or sometimes I'm lucky enough to get a little part on a TV or film, I'll think about Armando's class. I'll try to use sense memory and be like, what did it feel like when I was in Armando's class? I felt like I was invincible. I need that feeling. And so it was kind of like a confidence boost like I'd never had before. Plus some brilliant side coaching. I mean, it was, he showed me what it felt like to be good already before I was good.
Yeah, so there's an element of reps that is, I think, a part of any improviser's growth, and then the coaching to get you there, where I think most of the time it's kind of the other way. You get the coaching and the training, and then you get the reps afterwards. It's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it was, you know, when I became a teacher, I tried to emulate that, but as my students now know, I've destroyed it and I talk way too much. But I remember well. I mean, that's not true. Sometimes I will do it. If I'm ruining a class, if I've put them all in their heads, I'll be like, all right, Will Hines, I'll tell myself, you shut up for the next 20 minutes, no notes, just get them up. Just give everybody a rep, even if they're terrible, just get them a rep and let them keep going. And I'll let everybody get up twice and everybody does 2 minute scenes. And so there's 16 2 minute scenes. It takes half an hour or so, like 35 minutes. And then the class is like healed. Yeah. And that is something I've learned from Armando for sure.
And then Ian was the third one you mentioned.
So Ian was special because Ian was by far the best improviser of, I mean, no disrespect to Kevin or Armando, but Ian is like another level. He is like a master. He's incredibly funny. He thinks a million miles a minute. He himself is a cartoon character of neurosis and awkwardness. And it makes his performance very funny. And so here's a guy where you're now apprenticing with someone who's doing it at a high level. But his approach was very, very simple. He basically had a simple approach. And when he was teaching, he would use that approach in every scene. And if the scene didn't fit that approach, he would admit it, but he would kind of discard it and be like, well, we're not going to worry about this. And his approach was just basically like, play it real, act like real life. Have one unusual thing only that you have like a blind spot to. Mm-hmm. So to this one unusual thing, you're going to allow it to live, even though in real life you'd squash it. Mm-hmm. And everything else, you'd be real and repeat it and heighten it. But he wouldn't even worry about the heightening too much. It was like, if you act like real life and you have just one unusual thing that you allow to live, the improv will work. And so his notes would all be like, is that what you would really say? What would you really say to somebody in this situation? Or it would be like, well, we had two unusual things, so pick one. You only get one. Don't start this other unusual thing while this first one is playing. You know, or it would be like, hey, wait a minute. You were supposed to have a blind spot to this unusual thing. Don't call it out now. Or, okay, we have our unusual thing. You're the voice of reason. You can react to it normally. But it was all in the terms of like, there was tons of what would you say? What would you say? What would you say? And it was by the end of it, it was like we were all being ourselves way more. Then ironically, we got funnier. I was like, oh, my real self is quite funny if there's an unusual thing present. Like I have a weird little neurotic energy that I wasn't aware of that exists. And if I just act like myself, it's funny.
Yeah.
Like I am a comedic persona, you know, which I had never thought of myself as.
One of the challenges, I suppose, for somebody going into improv is, well, if people around me don't see me as funny, is this something that I can do well? And I think part of what you're saying is if you are real and authentic, you just might be able to pull it off.
Yeah. Ian would end every class by doing a scene with somebody. He would basically get bored and be like, all right, I'm going to do a scene. And I loved it because it would be at the end. It'd be like the last, I don't know, 5 or 7 minutes. First of all, different people would volunteer. So over the course, you would see him perform with sort of different talent levels. Like maybe the funny, confident person goes up 1 week and then the unconfident, not so funny person goes up the next week. But his approach never changed and the scene was always good. And he really did practice what he was preaching. Like it wasn't like he said one thing and did another. He was doing what he said. And so you could watch it being done at this high level. You're like, oh, yeah, he's saying what somebody would say. Oh, yeah, he's got a blind spot to that unusual thing there. Oh, but how about when the person tries to deny him? Oh, he just folds that in and accepts the denial as fact. He doesn't let it slow him down. He doesn't argue anything. And I think about those scenes still. And I took him 4 times. I was like, I need more. I got to keep watching him. I loved it.
So I want to talk about your latest book that you did with Billy Merritt.
I would love to. It's nice that you're asking.
Well, I read it, and I've recommended this one as well. When I saw that it was a fable, I was predisposed to think it was campy or something. But and I interviewed Billy earlier in the second episode of the podcast and talked about how it ended up being, it had a classroom feel to it. But as he talked about it, there was some aspects of the book and this, I don't know, fabled improv school that you constructed to almost create a full school of thought on improv. Can you talk a little bit about what you think Pirate Robot Ninja stands for?
Yeah. There's two things about this book. And I think we were a little muddled when we did it. But two things that I think we got right were Pirate Robot Ninja, which is a metaphor that Billy Merritt, my co-author, has been using for years, is basically like, it's basically like pirate and robot, and then ninja is when you're both. So pirate is like an actor who's very impulsive and literal and emotional, and a robot is the writer who's very abstract and detached, but good at repeating patterns and forcing things to happen when they need to happen on schedule. So Pirate's the actor, Robot's the writer, and Ninja is somebody who is deft enough to transform as needed to be an actor sometimes and a writer other times. That's the overall thesis of the book. The fable part happened because, so I wrote my other book first, right? How to be the greatest improviser on earth. And it's sort of like, it doesn't tell you how to do improv. It's just sort of like, hey, if you're already doing improv, here's some things you can think about. But there's no way in. It's not like good for new people at all. And I wanted something that was more of an introduction of how to do it. So although Pirate Robot Ninja is not a total introduction, it's meant to be more basic. Like, have you never done scenes? Like there's a bunch of, I taught in China for a little while, and these students from China say, oh, we all bought your book and we're getting it translated. And I was like, oh my God, I don't know if that book's going to be helpful. So I was like, maybe this fable, this like story of how to do scenes will be more helpful for beginners. That was the thought. And Billy also is just very fun and like good at like playing make-believe and doing fun genre stuff like samurai and ninjas. And I was like, it feels like it'll be like a Billy class if the whole book is just a pirate teacher who serves you chicken cordon bleu and then like teaches you an improv lesson. That feels kind of Billy. Pirate Robot Ninja is a metaphor for the actor and the writer sides of your brain. And then the fable is because we wanted it to be fun, good for beginners, and for it to feel as fun as a Billy Merritt class. That was our plan. It's probably not as much for advanced students, except maybe if you're teaching, there might be some good metaphors and ideas in there to use for teaching.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it also is if you aren't, if you're not going through a UCB curriculum, I think it does give you a little bit of an insight in terms of the approach of the UCB generally in a different light than going through the UCB manual would.
Yeah. It's supposed to, you know, I love the manual, and we're actually working on a second edition of that UCB manual now, and I'm involved in that. It won't be like drastically different, but we're going to update some of the terms, and there's some minor errors we want to correct, and we want to update some of the examples to be a bit better. The bulk of it will be the same.
One of the things that I remember hearing a number of people say after the manual came out is the concept of framing sounded like it almost came out of that book.
Oh, yeah,
and
I love
then
that.
Became a very useful handle for a bigger concept.
Totally agree. The terms base reality and framing were invented in the book. Those are big UCB terms now.
Okay.
There's nothing big like that coming. It's more like, I love the book, but I think it's like a bit drier than necessary. And I'm going to write, this is the plan. Maybe it'll change by the time it comes out, but like, I'm going to write a new introduction and some intros to each chapter that try to just like set the context a little bit better. Like, okay, here's what we're going to learn in this chapter. And it comes from this. And, and that's what the idea is. And then the rest of the chapter will be the same. And then some of the examples will be different. And I think the pattern game section is being tweaked a little bit. And we might have some new illustrations. There's not fundamentally new information coming. It's just like, we're trying to dial back the textbookness of it a little bit and have it be more like human being talking about the stuff. My main criticism of the book when I read it was, I mean, on the good side, the information is amazing. It is, I feel like I'm in a class with Besser and Ian and Walsh, which is what they wanted. But I was like, you're not, it's a little less fun than an improv class. Like, improv is really fun and exciting. And that doesn't come through in the book too much, I don't think. And I don't need it to be like do a ton of song and dance and salesmanship. But I think a little choice adjustments here or there will go a long way towards humanizing it. That's really the only change. A little bit of the context, but all the information will be the same. So when the book first came out, I wrote my book, How to Be the Greatest Improviser on Earth, after sort of as like, well, my book's going to be all heart. Like, just here's what I love about it. And here's some fun stuff. And their book is like how to do it, like the actual instructions. And mine was going to be like, okay, once you know how to do it, here's some more inspirational stuff, roughly speaking. It was written in sort of in reaction to the scholarly tone of the UCB manual, even though I do love that.
In the notion of base reality, you move from yes anding to get to that base reality to if then, once you have some things that are established, whether that's the unusual thing that you're leaping off of, but it's also rest of the base reality. I wanted to just get your thought on the aspect of base reality when someone comes into a scene, a walk-on, or they're just the second character in the scene, but someone makes an initiation that is inconsistent or apparently inconsistent with what that person's coming in on. So they're coming in as a drill sergeant sergeant. And then the other player says, "Grandma, can you set the table?" How much of that unspoken offer or characterization do you view as part of the base reality because it's something that the audience has seen?
I mean, 100%. Like, that is, I mean, that's basically a mistake that has to be dealt with. I mean, improv is designed so those mistakes can be fun and it can be a good time, but you screwed up. Like, you misread your partner very, very early. I don't mean to say that punitively, but to act like it, I don't agree with the everything's good, everything's good. We have to love everything, love everything. I don't believe that's true. Some things work great as is, and some things create a lot of work to do. The work is fun and you can enjoy it, but that's still the truth. You know, if it's like, "Chuck, step into my office. I want to talk about your work performance this year." And you go, "Okay, here I am." Well, we've got a base reality. We can now move on to other stuff. But if somebody comes on as a drill sergeant and I say, "Grandma, what are you doing?" That's a denial. Like, I am refuting your offer and creating a problem. If we're good improvisers, we can work with it and make it work. But we can't move on now until we've addressed that. And I don't, you know, if you're learning, that's bad form. It's like, it's advanced stuff. It's like inbounding a basketball and then throwing it in the wrong direction for sport. It can still be all right. You can catch the ball and dribble it back in the right direction, but don't do that when you're learning. And my question would be, is it intentional or unintentional? If it's intentional, it is straight up bad form and you shouldn't do it. That is just sort of like knocking the legs out from underneath the scene. You're being a little stinker and it's just not worth it. If it's unintentional, if you just didn't notice they were being a drill sergeant, and maybe because of the suggestion or because of something you're doing, you legitimately assumed they were your grandmother, well, there probably was something in the scene that led to you thinking that. And so that means really it's less of a mistake than it might be. And there's a way for both people to yes and it.
Right. And I think that's in part what your "Keep the Music, Change the Lyrics" is something that is mentioned in both books. And I feel the way that you described it in both books was also almost like you were pulling back from it. And I don't know if that's true or if I'm misreading that. Is that something that you feel still needs to be fleshed out a little bit, that concept?
The "Keep the Music, Change the Lyrics" one? It's definitely not something that's taught a lot. So I guess I don't know for sure how well it holds up as a solid rule. But I'll tell you that that's what I do. If I come marching in as a military dude, right? Like, rigid posture, stomping in, coming in with a big full head of steam. If I say, "Soldiers, 10 hut," and then you call me grandmother, like, you're straight up doing bad improv. Mm-hmm. Like, you are just not listening at all. You're denying everything. Like, it's really, I said soldiers, you know what I mean? Right. Like, you're like being crazy, I think. Like, that's bad. We're not supposed to say you make mistakes, but you made a mistake. You misheard the word soldiers. That's the fastest path to making this better. However, what I would do, just tone, it's more expensive to change tone than it is to change words. If I totally drop my energy and change to a grandmother, it just feels very jarring and the scene is like broken. I have to keep that energy that I have, but I can yes and me being a grandmother with the same energy that I have. I've been in the Marines 70 years, and just because you're my grandchild doesn't mean I'm going easy on you, you know? The audience would roll with that no problem. Like, it would even be really enjoyable. So just from my own practical experience of doing it, the words are very interchangeable. You can always change your specifics with almost no loss of momentum, but it's really hard to change your tone unless something has happened to really motivate it emotionally. Like, if I come in with a head of steam and you said, "Grandma, I love you," like this emotionally affecting thing, then I would have motivation to soften. You know, I'd be like, "Whoa, sweetheart, I wasn't expecting that. My gosh. Well, but listen, 10 hut, drop it, give me 20. I'm not going easy on you." So it's like, yeah, I don't know, like tone, keep the tone, but you can do all your yes anding with your words and it'll work.
I think there is a natural tendency to, in some ways, especially in that first offer that you're responding to drop everything too quickly to become something else. And like you said, that's jarring. You almost have to reestablish or work harder to establish a new base reality and wait for the audience to forget what they saw in your character coming on stage. Well, I think it's a good principle. It may not be as taught as much as it should, but I think it does help.
I think it does help, and it works a lot, and it's. I think it should be gospel.
Okay, so now you're on board.
I think we should all adopt it as a thing to teach, because I think it works. Yeah. I'm on board with what I said.
It is unnatural, which in some ways gets back to how do you be present in a way, but you're trying to act like a normal human being. But that's not quite what you're doing, because you're going to lean into those unusual things. It's almost like you have to have an 8-year-old sensibility of just saying whatever would come into your mind unfiltered and be that person as an adult, which is not natural for us.
Yeah, no, it's not natural. I mean, it depends what kind of person you are. Like, there are some people who in real life have walls up so much. They try to win every conversation. They're always one-upping. They're bad listeners. They're like radios. They just try to set. They're not on input ever. They say what they want to say, and they don't listen to what's being. Those people have a lot more work to do to become a good improvisers. But on the other hand, there's also people who are really just good at like listening and reacting and being affected, and their walls are not so much up, and they have a much shorter path to being a good actor for sure and a good improviser. But anybody could do it if they want to. Like, I think my walls were up pretty high. They still go up a lot of times, but I because I loved the product so much, I destroyed my personality until I became the kind of person who was good at improv.
I know we're coming up on time on the interview portion here. I want to ask you at least a couple things. I wanted to ask you about the blow them away exercise. That is something you mentioned in
That
would be the greatest improvise. But it doesn't really go into like the mechanics of it other than it could be just that's just an attitude to have and go do it.
Yeah.
How do you do that exercise?
Yeah. I don't have mechanics for it. Like, I just say, all right, guys, I want to be blown away. So, and I give them an example. I'm like, so do something in every scene to blow me away. And then I just kind of leave it on them to do it. Like, they have to be creative and just think of, it's just very subjective. And I have to be very forgiving about what is constituting, as long as they're trying something. I think sometimes exercises they work if they're very structured. And your action is very dictated. But other times, it's good as a teacher to not structure it. And the fun is how they're going to do it. A friend of mine, Chris Gethard, when he was a teacher, I know that at some point he was coaching improv teams. And he was saying, all right, we're going to do scenes that are impossible. I want to do scenes that are impossible. Like, that seem like they should be impossible, either because of where they take place or what somebody's attitude is. Or breaking the laws of physics to such a degree. But he didn't specify too much. He was like, just let's do it. And sometimes it would be like aliens in a star field in multiple dimensions. And sometimes it would be like characters who didn't know each other and didn't care about each other, you know, breaking a lot of like improv recommendations. And then the people would be on them to make it work anyway. And I think sometimes giving a challenge like that, like do an impossible scene, is like, that's the way to go as a teacher. Like, see what they do with it. They're sick of you dictating their actions so strictly. They're in the class, so let them have a chance to do something. So the blow them away is one of those, like, just like, all right, blow me away. And I tell the story about the thing. I'm like, just, I want to be blown away, like have something amazing happen.
Is there a new exercise that you're enjoying playing with of late?
Yeah, we put it in Pirate Robot Ninja, but it's just a, I think I don't even have a name for it yet, but something like just a pickle, which is like, it's just a warm-up exercise to practice making things important philosophically. So one person says to another, what are you so mad about? It's just a blank. And they name something like, what are you so mad about? It's just a vacuum cleaner. I mean, we don't even know what's going on, right? But the point of this exercise is that the person has to defend the importance of the vacuum cleaner. And you have to go, what do you mean just a vacuum cleaner? Just a vacuum cleaner? And then you have to, like, on your feet, philosophize about the importance of it. You know, this vacuum cleaner is all that separates us from our irresponsible youth. Every time we clean the rug, we are declaring a responsibility in adulthood here, that we care about our home and are responsible for it. Just a vacuum cleaner, sir?
Some similarities to the accept all accusations type exercise as well, I think. Because you have to double down on it somehow or other.
The double down on it. This one's more about like importance, like be able to make a mundane thing have emotional weight.
I wish we had more time, but I really appreciate you spending some time sitting down with me and sharing a lot of your perspective and some of the history of how you work through some things in improv. And hopefully we get a chance to talk again sometime soon.
Thanks so much, Whit. I appreciate it.
Oh, so much good stuff. Will's done so much great thinking about improv, and you really should grab his books, as he does a great job of laying out and sharing what that thinking is in a really accessible way. I love the focus on presence as part of doing improv well, and I'm still waiting on getting Will's videos of his performance as Fitzgerald, the archenemy of Santa Claus, but the description of that moment when he first felt like he was doing improv right is one that I think all solid improvisers should be able to relate to, and reflecting back on those moments of simplicity and connection should remind us that a lot of solid improv is just being in the moment. It's hard to have a 45-minute conversation about the intricacies of the art form and to be able to say it with a straight face, but eventually you've just got to do and not overthink. For those of you that teach, you'll likely want to re-listen to the description of what Will got out of his time training with Armando Diaz, Kevin Mullaney, and Ian Roberts. Two things that stood out were the importance of getting out of the way when you're teaching and staying focused and not overcomplicating scenes. But there's a lot more than that, too, as you just heard. I'll put links to the books and other things on the episode page at Improv Comedy Connection, but I hope you found this episode and the podcast generally to be useful to you. If it has, please spread the word, rate, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast. I mentioned that this is about the halfway point in the first season of the podcast, and my intention is to take stock of what I'm doing well and what I could do better. So if you have an idea as to how this could be more useful to you, or you got a great idea for a topic or a guest for a future episode, please do let me know. I invite that feedback because I'm doing this to be of help to you as we work together to connect more deeply with each other and our audiences through comedy. I've really enjoyed being your host on this episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. My name again is Whit Schiller, and I'm an improviser out of Milwaukee with Fishsticks Comedy. You can check us out at fishstickscomedy.com, and you can connect with me on social media at Whit Schiller on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Just so we're clear, though, you can no longer find me on Club Penguin. I'm not sure what happened there, but that site has been overrun by corporate interests, and I'm no longer interested. Thanks again for tuning in to the Improv Comedy Connection.